requirements for chairing at a meeting at Central Orlando Group is to have 1 year of continuous sobriety, which I do, and have Central as your home group, but that's for you, which I do, and you do too. And I'm not going to qualify because I can just say I drank like an alcoholic for many, many years. I didn't think I drank like an alcoholic, which my denial was deep. And then once I realized that I was an alcoholic, I didn't know what to do about it. And someone said, try AA. And I said, no, thank you. I'll pass. Let's not do anything extreme. And let's not get crazy. I mean, I still have 2 cars left in total. And, you know, it was after totaling those 2 cars and living in a closet, which I always say was a really nice closet because it had a window. I mean, I can justify anything. You know, forget that I was in Mayaca City and the only thing that they sold at the gas station there was deer urine and fried chicken. I mean, that's really where I was. That I decided maybe it was time to try AA. And that was 6:30:06, and that was my white chip, and that was the last white chip I ever had to pick up. That was my first and my last. So if you're wondering if this program works, if I can do it, coming out of a closet in Mayaca City, so can you. And our speaker tonight is Erica. And I just want to say something really quickly. When I first moved here, I was pissed. I moved up here from Key West. My home group was in Key West. You know, everyone that I held near and dear to me was in Key West. My life was in Key West. However, my future husband was in Orlando. So I had to make a decision. And, you know, that decision was that I had to move because I knew that, you know, I loved him and we were going to get married. And that's what needed. There was a hesitant moment there for a second, but that's what needed to happen. And one of the biggest things for me was that I was really scared to leave my home group. That was my home. You know, my sponsor there told me, anywhere you go, AA is. And I had started over in AA. I've moved like 6 times in sobriety. And I knew what that entailed. I was just really comfortable at that point in my sobriety in Key West. Really comfy. And I came here, and you all did the chips backwards. And, you know, you chair meetings here for like 18 years when you take on a commitment. Like, everything was like so backwards. And, like, I was like, I don't even know if I can do this. You know, very dramatic. And, I didn't really like anyone, obviously, because that's how I am in the beginning. I never like anyone. And Erica sat down next to me. I think it was my, like, 2nd meeting. And she was like, hey. And I was like, hello. You know? Already convinced in my head that, like, this place doesn't have a beach and I can't go paddleboarding and I hate everyone here. And she was like, are you new? Or she said something like that. I was like, I have 7 years because I'm that cool. You know, I'm that girl. And, which means shit. And she was like, oh, okay. And kind of like, looked the other way. And she just kept talking to me. And by the end of the meeting, I was so grateful for her, you know, because I wasn't going to talk. I wasn't going to do it. That's who I am. I'm working on it. But she just wouldn't give up. She just fought right through it. And she was like, you learn to love it here. Or she said something like that. And I was like, who is this? She's like, I come to this meeting every week. And lo and behold, that time came around. I'm going to start to really cry now. That time came around next week. And I told my husband, I was like, dude, there's this girl. She's a little shot out, but I really like her. And she goes to this meeting, so I'm going to go tonight, babe, okay? He's like, whatever. And I went, and there she was, and I was like, hey. She's like, hey, you came back. And I sat next to her that night, and she's like, we should go do something. And I was like, and I really don't think that I've left her coattails since then. And I can honestly say that she's one of my best friends here. Like, when I have shit going on, I call Erica. And it just goes to show you that it does not matter how much time you have. It does not matter. 7 years, 20 years, 1 year, it doesn't matter. When I need a solution, I can always count on Erica to give it to me. And with that, I give you her. Oh.
My name's Erica. I am an alcoholic. Ooh, a little pressure now. I just just want to start by saying, just because it brings me, like, a little peace when I say this, my favorite sentence, my favorite line out of the big book is out of We Agnostics, when it says, the consciousness of the presence of God is the most important fact of my life today. Because without my faith, I could not get up here and talk about myself. Even though I'm a self-centered alcoholic and you give me a microphone and I get to talk about myself, my favorite topic, like, that's great, but I'm a little nervous. So, I was born in New Orleans to an alcoholic father and a very codependent mother. And we moved to Florida when I was about 3 years old. And I don't talk too much about, like, my parents because I don't feel like I became an alcoholic because of my childhood. Like, I truly believe I was born, you know, with this genetic predisposition. Granted, it ran in my family. My father was an alcoholic. My mom's father was an alcoholic. But I had the ism from very young. And one of my earliest memories, and I like to share this because it just makes a lot more sense out of other things in my, you know, my future. I was 4 years old, and it was my cousin's birthday. And my family was arranging and planning for his birthday party. And the attention and the spotlight wasn't on me. And I wasn't getting what I wanted, how I wanted it, when I wanted it. So I took off. I ran away at the age of four. I remember walking out of the front door, going down the block, taking a right, and going up to some stranger's house. And they were neighbors. You know, they knew who I was. And they called my mom at work and all of this, but it made a lot of sense to me when I got older and I looked back at that, because I'm a runner, you know, like when things don't go my way and I get scared, I leave. My famous words are, I'm done, and I take off, and, you know, so I don't want to spend too much time on my childhood, because I don't believe that I'm an alcoholic, because my parents failed me in any ways, even though there were some issues. We're just gonna set those aside, you know. So I had my first drink of alcohol when I was 12 or 13, and I remember it vividly. I drank alcoholically. I drank to a blackout, to where I was falling down in a closet with two of my girlfriends. I remember it like yesterday. We were drinking gin and Sunny Delight. Terrible. You know, and well, gin and juice, but we didn't have the orange juice, so we pulled Sunny Delight, you know. We were like, orange juice. So we were so drunk. We were smoking cigarettes in the closet. We're burning each other with them, and it was great, you know. I was like, oh, this is awesome. This is amazing. So after that, you know, I looked forward to every chance that I could to drink. You know, growing up, like, I had everything I wanted. I had every opportunity for everything. My parents were hardworking parents. You know, I wasn't rich, wasn't well-to-do, but my parents provided for my sister and I. And I did well in school, you know, and I always had a bunch of friends. And I was, you know, I consider myself, I was pretty popular, you know, and but I wasn't happy. And I had this soul sickness that I did not understand, and I couldn't put words to it, and I couldn't explain it to you. And when I consumed that gin and Sunny Delight, I was like, oh, this is it. Like, I felt okay with myself, and I wanted more and more of it. And, you know, I've listened to a lot of speakers, and I've heard it said before that, you know, I had 10 years, 15 years without consequences, really, really good times. That was not my case. You know, I was 12 or 13 when I had my first drunk and immediately slid into consequences, whether it was legal, you know, internal consequences, most of all legal, and, you know, I jumped right into the pitiful and comprehensible demoralization. There was no enjoyment for me, really, and I got real comfortable in that pitiful and comprehensible demoralization. At 14 years old, I was charged with my first DUI, 20 felonies and 3 misdemeanors, and I was charged as an adult. And I was actually on Colonial. I was actually on Colonial coming back from a nightclub, you know, it was 7 a.m., and I was driving a car. And I wrecked the car. I was 14 years old, and I consumed lots of alcohol and outside issues as well. And, you know, when they rushed me to the hospital in the emergency room, and this is just, you know, my sponsor likes to say that it's always easier to see God in our lives when we turn around and look back, you know, and that's why I like seeing the consciousness of God in my life is the most important fact, because I can see him today. But I can look back and see where God was in my life. And I lived in Lake Mary. I grew up in Lake Mary, and I was 14 years old, and I was on Colonial coming home from a nightclub. And the man that lived across the street from me most of my life saw me nosedive when I went to step out of the vehicle to switch sides with the legal age driver before the cops got there. And he saw me faceplant into the asphalt and called my mother. So she knew to contact hospitals. They rushed me to ORMC and said I was overdosed. And by the time my mom got there, I just thought I was feeling really good, you know? I was like, this is a really good night. And they told my mother that I was going to suffer brain damage and that I would need plastic surgery to reconstruct my face. Like, it was that severe. And that was the incident I got the DUI and 20 felonies and 3 misdemeanors because I had some stuff in my pocket. You know, I walked away from that. Well, I woke up a few days later, and I had no brain damage, you know, and I have not one scar on my face, but I had to have asphalt medically, surgically removed out of my face, and I don't have any scars, you know, so that's a miracle when I look back on that. And so the consequences, I had to drop out of the 8th grade so that I could report to 33rd Street every month to my my teachers wouldn't have understood that, you know. So I was on community control until I was 19 and had a bunch of other, you know, stuff that I had to abide by. But I ended up going back to high school my junior year. And because I was like, I got to get out of this town, you know. It's the town. It's Orlando, it's Lake Mary, it's the people, it's not me, it's them. So I was like, okay, let me go back to school, went back to high school, and I did really, really well. I was in AP and honors classes, I graduated high school with college credit, and I was like, this is my ticket out of here, you know? And I got early acceptance to an out-of-state university. So it was the summer, you know, before my junior year of high school, and I went to New Orleans, where I was originally from and had family, and I saw a girl laying on the lakefront, drinking a beer, studying her textbook in her bathing suit. And I was like, oh, this is the place for me. Like, this is where I'm going to fit in, you know? And these are my people. And so I worked my butt off. I got early acceptance into University of New Orleans. And so right after I graduated high school, I moved to New Orleans. I did really well in college. I like to say that I majored in drinking and I minored in drugs, you know, but somehow I did really well on the outside. I was on the dean's list, I was published, you know, I worked on a mayoral campaign, intern for a judge, all these really, really good things that if you were judging me from the outside, I was accomplishing things, I should have been happy, and I was dying inside. And when I was 19 years old, I could not stop drinking. Like, my alcoholism was getting really, really bad, and I was always surrounded by people. I was in a sorority, and I was the loneliest person. Like, I lived in loneliness and despair, and I think the only reason they didn't kick me out of the sorority is because they were a little scared. I got a little violent when I drank, so they would never try to curb my drinking, and they would never ask me to kindly leave the sorority, but I had been on a 4-day bender, and I called my mom in Florida, and I was like, I can't live like this anymore. And I told my dad's gone out, because I was raised around guns, and I was very comfortable with him. And I was like, I can't live like this anymore. She goes, you just got to stop drinking. I'm like, I can't stop. I don't know how to. I am an alcoholic, and I'm an addict. Like, I can't do this. And So I said, you better do something from Florida, or, you know, like, this is not going to end well. So she calls and she finds a detox. So I drive myself to my first detox at 19 in New Orleans, and I walk in, and I was in there for 4 to 5 days, and this was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. Some people brought in a meeting, and I remember they're all sitting there with their blue books, you know, and I'm like, I don't know what this is about, and but I remember when, I don't know what was said, what was talked about, any of that, but when it came around to me and I said, my name is Erica and I am an alcoholic, I could breathe because it made sense, finally, like it talks about in the big book, in the doctor's opinion, like, finally, all of this makes sense because I can't explain why I do the things that I did. I can't explain why I couldn't control the amount of alcohol I consumed, or I never knew what was going to happen, and I couldn't stay away from that first drink. So I had this relief, you know, I'm like, okay, I'm an alcoholic, that makes a lot of sense, because I said it 1,000 times, but not around other people who were self-admitting, you know, that they were alcoholics. So I got out of there, and I'd get 30 days and go celebrate, you know, and then I'd get another 30 days, and I'd go celebrate, I'm like, I did great, and, you know, I ended up, my parents were like, this is it. You've got to come home from New Orleans because this isn't good. So I come home, and I go from on track heading to law school after my bachelor's, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to switch my life plan, and I'm going to go to cosmetology school. So my parents were really proud, you know, and I'm like, okay. But I had changed my goals to meet my drinking, you know, like, I wanted somewhere where I could get away with drinking and doing other things the way I wanted to. So I went to cosmetology school, and within a year I was in my first inpatient treatment facility. And I got out of there, and within a month I met a man on the AA campus, you know, and I was pregnant a year later. So I wasn't able to get any more time than 6 months together, and so I was pregnant, and I was scared, and but I thought, okay, this little baby is going to fill this hole that I have deep down in my soul. He's going to, he or she, at the time I didn't know, is going to love me unconditionally, like I was always going to have that constant love. That's all I ever wanted. Like, I just wanted to be loved. And I wanted to be a part of, and I didn't want to feel separated from. And so I put all this on this little baby in my belly, like, poor thing, never knew he had all this pressure coming into the world, you know? So I have my son, and I have this amazing, beautiful baby boy, which I'm sure a lot of you know, because he's like the mascot of Central. He's here all the time. And so I have this baby, and I still couldn't stay. It just, and it kills me to say this, but it just wasn't enough, you know, like, because I had that deep-rooted hole inside of my soul that only God could fill. I didn't know that then. Like, I tried to fill it with men, with money, with booze, with my son, shopping, like, whatever it was, you know. I tried everything externally to fill this God-shaped hole that I had, and I didn't know it was God-shaped. You know, so I have this amazing son, and I'm bouncing out of AA back and forth, and I just can't stay sober, and I end up in treatment again when he's almost a year old, and I got, let's see, my third DUI. I got a DUI when I was in New Orleans, and I got a DUI 2007 or 2009. I'm going to jump forward. In June 11, 2011, it was the day before my son's 6th birthday, and I was taking him to the beach, and I love when it talks about in Bill's story, it says the ominous warning, you know, and I kept seeing his flashing signs, DUI, decide before you drive. Now, meanwhile, I've had 3 DUIs at this point, and I'm like, oh, man, I don't want to drink, you know. That time came, the mental blank spot where I had no defense between me and a drink, you know, and I had a great day planned at the beach for my son's birthday, and I had no desire to drink, but I had no defense, and I'm an alcoholic. So I ended up drinking at the beach with my kid and drank to a blackout, ended up two counties over and got a DUI with my son in the car. You know, like, again, we get sober, we work the steps, and we look at our past through new eyes. And I'm so grateful for that DUI, because if I hadn't gotten it, I would have killed my son, myself, and countless others. I was in a blackout and didn't even know how I got from Volusia County to Brevard County. You know, and so my son had to witness that. And that wasn't the worst thing. The worst thing is when your five-year-old little boy looks at you and says, "Mommy, you're really mean when you drink. I hate when you drink alcohol. Alcohol's bad." You know, but it talks about it in the big book. That frothy emotional appeal is not sufficient for me to say, "Oh, okay, I'm going to stop." You know, it just wasn't. I had passed that line where it says, when, you know, it had become a necessity. Didn't matter how much I wish I couldn't drink, I had to. Like, I had lost that choice, the power of choice, lost, gone. I had to. I was a slave to alcohol and other substances. So once I got this fourth DUI, my son witnessed it, I got out of jail. I lost everything at this point. And this is when, you know, I'm very general about my outside issues and other things, but when it comes to this, I'm going to bring it up, because I tapped into this darkness. I had a no-contact order on me, so the judge put, "You're a danger to your child and you're a danger to yourself. Do not contact your son anymore." Meanwhile, I had been in a custody battle this time, so that didn't look too well for my case, you know, and it talks about, and there's a solution, when it describes the types of alcoholics, when it describes the real alcoholic, and it says, you know, at times we will mix liquor with a high power sedative, you know, and that's exactly what I was going into. Liquor had stopped working, you know, it wasn't blotting out that consciousness anymore, and I didn't want to live. Like, I had so much shame and guilt attached surrounding being a mother alcoholic and how it had affected my child over and over, year after year. And that I started using the most high-powered sedative that you can find, you know, and I started mixing booze and heroin. And I was on a death mission. And you know, and I only bring that up because it says it in our literature. And I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but deep in my core, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a real alcoholic. I'm of the hopeless variety. You know, I thought this shit was not going to work for me. These 12 steps are not going to work. Your higher power is not going to work for me. I tried this year after year after year, and I could not stay sober. I could get sober. I couldn't stay sober. And that was self-defeating in itself, you know? And so I had the no-contact order, started injecting heroin, mixing it with my liquor. So I had hit a nerve in my right arm, ended up in the hospital. They said, "You're not going to be able to use your right arm." I'm a hairstylist. Like, I'm screwed, you know? I lost the use of my arm, no-contact order, the 5-year revocation on my license. You know, because it was my fourth DUI within 15 years. It was getting pretty serious. And so I was on a death mission. I couldn't do it. Like, I kept living. I was like a cockroach, you know? Like, nothing would work. And I know today it's because God had a bigger purpose for me. Like, my life was hopeless and futile, like the book talks about. There's no useful purpose for me when I'm drinking alcohol. And so there's a story in the doctor's opinion. It's the last story that Dr. Silkworth is writing about. And it says, you know, whenever I need a mental uplift, I think of this man who was deserted in a barn. Well, mine wasn't a barn. It was a house. But it was me. I had deserted myself in this house with liquor and high power sedatives and was just trying to off it and just end it all and blot out all consciousness, and it wouldn't happen. So an old sponsor of mine from Winter Park Group showed up and said, if you want to live, you give me a call. And they intervened. And her, another friend from AA, and my son's father all marched and acted me. They did for me what I could not do for myself, you know, and it was divine intervention. So I went to treatment. And I was defiant to the core. I ended up getting kicked out of treatment. Like, I didn't want to drink or use anymore, but I couldn't let go of these character defects, you know? Like, it talks about in the 12 and 12. As long as we never say, no, I'm not, you know, I never want to give this up. There were a few I wasn't willing to give up at that point, and self-reliance was one of them. And I got kicked out of treatment and moved in with a friend. I'm sitting up here for a little bit, and I was able to put 14 months together, and for me, I smashed the idea that alcohol, I couldn't consume alcohol safely, I couldn't drink alcohol, it wasn't a solution anymore, but I hadn't smashed all my old ideas, who I was supposed to be, what my life was supposed to look like, how I was supposed to be treated. Kind of, you know, that I have a child with somebody, did it, how that's supposed to look. I couldn't smash all those old ideas. And I didn't have, I drank, you know, I picked up a drink again. And I'm really grateful I did, because it changed my whole world. In that moment, I had my darkest hour, I struck gold. You know, I finally had that gift of desperation where my self-reliance had failed me. Utterly. Like, there was no more thought that my way, my ideas were going to work. You know, and the book tells me, my ideas don't work, but the God idea does. And I hadn't fully surrendered my will and my life to the care of God, the protection and care of my God, like our literature says, you know. And once those ideas were smashed, I came in with this desperation that we read about, the desperation of a drowning man. You know, and I'd heard for years, these are just suggestions, these are suggestions. For me, it was no longer a suggestion. I needed clear-cut directions of how to live, because I was going to die. You know, my last drink, I drank for 2 hours and consumed so much vodka. I ended up 3 blocks from my house, lost, passed out on the sidewalk. And that's how I drink. You know, I'm not the pretty little wine drinker at the wine bar. Like, it's just, you know, it's not pretty. I sought out those sordid places it's talked about in A Vision for You. Like, that's where I go. That's where I'm comfortable. That's my kind of people, you know? And so I'm grateful for the last drink that I took. I came in and I was willing to do things, everything different. I smashed all my old ideas, all my old conceptions, so that there was room for them to be replaced with new ones. You know, I came back in and I worked the steps with my sponsor again. And as soon as I was done, I was willing to carry the message to anybody that was willing to hear me, you know, and practice the principles and all my affairs to the best of my ability. And God started putting sponsees in my life, you know. That was the missing link. When I had the 14 months, I was like, I have nothing to offer. I don't need to be of service. I don't any of that. And when I look back over my 13 years in AA, the only thing I've done differently this past year is be of service. You know, I chair meetings. I go to my group conscience meetings. And if they need somebody to do something, I step up and say, I will. You know, and I sponsor girls. You know, and I love it. Because all that shame and guilt that I had and I harbored over all the things that I had done in my past, you know, my greatest asset to sit in front of another woman today and say, I know, I get it, because I did it, and this is how I don't do it anymore, you know, and I love in our book, like I love the Big Book, and I read it over and over, and you know, and I quote it a lot, and all of this because that's me. It was written about me in the 30s. This crazy woman sitting here in 2013. It's crazy, but you know, on the top of page 63. Anybody that knows me knows it's my favorite part of the book too. And you know, it says, when I sincerely take this position, the position being that God's going to be my director, I'm going to take a secondary position to God, remarkable things are going to follow. You know, I'm going to lose the fear of today, tomorrow, thereafter. We were reborn. And the person I am today is nothing like who came in 2 years ago and who I was before I picked up a drink a year and a week ago. You know, they told me, you got to change everything. I changed my hair color. I changed my profession. I changed everything because I just didn't want to die. You know, and today, so I came in with this is the good stuff. These are the miracles, the remarkable things that follow after I sincerely took the position that God was going to be my director. My five-year, I can clearly use my right arm again. That went away. It got better. And, you know, within months of that no-contact order, I had my son back full-time, you know, and he was living with me full-time. And my five-year revocation turned into a one-year suspension. Like, I don't know how and I don't know why. Just like, I don't know the how and why this program works. It just does. But I remember I went into the DMV and... my experience is once I'm willing to accept things the way they are, they miraculously change, you know? And I walk into the DMV and I'm like, you know, ma'am, I'm supposed to be up for a hardship here soon. What do I have to do? And she pulls up my information and she confirms that it's me and she's like, you've been eligible for a real license for 6 months. And I'm like, no, ma'am, you're wrong. I'm in total acceptance. I got 4 more years. She's like, no, ma'am, you've been eligible for 6 months. Are you sure about that? Are you talking about the same person? And she's like, you better leave my desk, ma'am. And I'm like, okay. You know? And I was with a friend, and I'm like, you're never going to believe this, but the same kind of miracle happened to her, so she did believe this, you know? And they wanted me to go to prison for that DUI. Like, I was looking at some serious time. I didn't go to prison. I went to treatment instead because I got honest with my attorney and the judge and said, I'm going to die from this disease if I don't get help. I didn't go to prison. I got my kid back. I can use my right arm. Like, all these things that I came in with. My problems were so huge when I came in 2 years ago. The book says when we straighten out spiritually, we straighten out mentally and physically. And to me, that means all that outside stuff is going to get better when I put God first in my life. You know, and so my son who I got the DUI in the car with him, it was almost 2 years to the day. I got my license back, and I showed up, I got off work, I was told I didn't have to work, so I showed up at the school, and I checked him out for the day, and I said, we're going to the beach. You know, and we had been to the beach since, but never just he and I, because I always had to get rides with other people, because I couldn't drive anymore, and I was able to take him back to the same beach that he saw his mommy get drunk and recreate the memory. Like the book says, we get to recreate our lives. And if your life was as bad and as hopeless and lonely and filled with despair as mine, when I read that in the book, I get to recreate my life. It was a promise. I didn't like who I was. I didn't like the things that I did. I didn't like how it affected the people that I loved. But I did the best I could with what I had when I had it. I had no choice. I lost the power of choice, you know? And so I got to recreate that memory, and I hauled butt back here to get to the 6th because that's my home group meeting. And I'm like, got to share with everybody what happened, you know? Like, and for me, the better that my life gets, the more I come here, you know? Like, I don't come to AA to get my life put back together and then stop coming. Because what we're told here is if we want to keep it, we got to give it away. And for me, what it is hope. And I was so, like it says, it doesn't matter how far down the scale we have gone. Like, I was in the negatives, You know, my scale, I had gone really, really low. I was hopeless, you know. And to be standing up here and to be sober and to live the life that I live today, freaking miracle, you know. It's just amazing. It's remarkable. And, you know, like, we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're supposed to have this blind faith that these steps on the wall are going to work. And we don't have to believe that we can believe that you believe, you know, and all of this, and we have this blind faith. And for me, I was willing to believe in a tree, you know, like, I just, whatever I had to do to not pick up a drink, I was willing to do this last time. And, my blind faith turned into faith, you know, because even after I drank the last time, a month later, since I was on probation, I had no possibility for early term, no getting off anything, and they said, oh, there's been a paperwork error, and you're going to have a warrant. You're going to have to go to jail. I'm like, but I'm sober. That's not right, you know? And I was willing to accept if I had to go into Brevard County Jail to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that's what I'm going to do. That's what God wants me to do. That's what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. I got a call the day before Thanksgiving. I'm like, oh, the warrant's been signed. Going in for Thanksgiving. And I was and I was at a bowling alley with a bunch of friends from here. And I walked outside to take the call. And she's like, are you sitting down? And I was like, yeah, I'll go ahead and sit down. And she's like, the judge successfully early terminated your probation. And said, whatever you're doing, keep doing it. Be good to your son. Like, it wasn't a possibility. What are you talking about? And she's like, oh, have Thanksgiving. Just accept it, you know? And I'm like, okay. And, you know, that's another miracle. Like, as long as I'm willing to play the role that God has assigned for me, then miracles happen. Like, my life is a miracle. And, you know, I don't always remember that. You know, like, I get fearful, and I get anxious, and I get crazy, and all of this. But my life is so surrounded with people doing the deal and walking the spiritual path that I choose to live, that they hold me up until I can stand up on my own. And that's what I've learned about Alcoholics Anonymous, is that when I came in, I didn't like myself, I didn't love myself, and I couldn't hold myself up. So women that did the deal before me, they held me up until I could love myself on my own. And they taught me how to be a mom. And they taught me how to be a woman. And they taught me how to be a friend and a girlfriend and a sponsor and all of these things. You know, that I had missed those lessons. And, you know, I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous and the women that did it before me. So, thanks.